Hey everybody, this is Brett. Welcome back to the show. Today is December 10th. What's coming up today is another portion of the live show from December 6th with Osborne and Marcus. And, oh, I gotta tell you, this one was kind of a misfire. I wanted to put it out anyway because it was an enjoyable conversation and I think it has some good food for thought, but it just progressed too slowly for us to even really get into the topic for the show. And, you know, that's one of the casualties of doing live radio, but I promise there is a consolation coming up. And, you know, you might enjoy this and you might find this to be a useful conversation. We spend the entire show talking about an article from Reason.com. The title of that piece was "Study Shows Smart Liberals, Conservatives, and Libertarians Are Easiest to Fool. We Reason to Persuade, Not to Find Truth," by Ronald Bailey. And I wanted to use that merely as a lead-in to the topic of cognitive distortion, but unfortunately, we never got to it. So here's what I did. I recorded a show last night with Wes Bertrand, who has a background in psychology, so he's probably the best person to do this with. We did a show that's roughly an hour and a half where we went through all of the cognitive distortions, and it's very good, and it will be entered into the Logic Saves Lives series. So that should be out a day after you hear this show. But thinking about how the live show doesn't always go exactly how I need it to go, I'm actually looking for some thoughts and some feedback on an idea that I have. I really like doing the live show. I really enjoyed the audience participation, even if it's not through phone calls. Like, you know, people are participating in the chat and we're trying to check on that during the breaks and have some dialogue with people that way. But the whole LRN thing with the commercial breaks is very restrictive, and I'm kind of over that. And I don't really think that really has much of a benefit for the show. So what I'm thinking about doing is to continue the live show as a more relaxed Ustream-only video show, ideally on Saturday, and we'll probably stay on for about 4 hours. During that time, we'll record two podcasts, and we'll still do the After School Sucks special that everyone loves so much, or maybe I'm the only person who loves that, but we'll keep doing that anyway. And it will still have the live show aspect to it where people can call in and participate, but it will be a little bit less frantic, and I'll be able to, you know, hit the topics a little deeper and more thoroughly than I've been able to do on the live show. Sometimes the pace of that just doesn't allow us to get into things how I would like, how we had been able to get into them in the more relaxed format of the podcast. So I think I just talked myself into it, but I would really like to hear your thoughts. And the other thing too, I had spent a couple months playing around with Sony Vegas Pro 10, learning the video production, and that was one of the easiest programs that I've ever used as far as how intuitive it is. And I'm sure there's a ton of stuff that it can do that I still haven't even gotten into yet. But I'm ready to start making some new videos, hopefully. And the video that I was making, I started planning this as we were getting into this Logic series. It was about the end of a podcast I did called The Natural State. And the setup is, you know, what if we all woke up tomorrow and government was gone? And what would happen if the worst case scenario played out from there? I think this is episode 41. From over a couple years ago. And then I go through creating this worst case scenario that, surprise, leads us right back to the current situation with the state. If every bad thing happened, we would be right back to where we are today. That is not perfectly logically sound, and I've been very reluctant to pursue that project for that reason. So I'm looking for some other ideas. I'm not saying that I couldn't go through with that one and find a way to do it that would satisfy me. I just haven't found it yet, so I've postponed that project. But I'd be interested to hear thoughts from people like, hey, you know, there was this segment of the show that was 3 minutes, and I think if you did this, this, and this, it would make a great video. It might just be the inspiration I need for someone to write to me and say, I would really like to see something like this visualized on YouTube. So those are some things on which I'm looking for some thoughts and feedback, and I hope you find today's show to be an enjoyable conversation. I will warn you, it doesn't have a lot of depth, so if you want to wait, the next episode should be just a day away. Wes Bertrand and I discuss cognitive distortions as part of the Logic Saves Lives series. Logic Saves Lives, Part 8. Okay. Happy holidays.
Hey everybody, this is Brett. Welcome to School Sucks Live. In the studio with me tonight, Osborne.
Happy damn Thursday, Brett.
And Marcus, a brand new co-host. I'm so excited that you're here.
I'm excited to be here.
We have a lot to go over. We're probably going to devote the first segment just to getting to know you. You're an old friend of mine. We've known each other for years.
Yes, we have.
I'm happy that you're in New Hampshire. You moved here as part of the Free State Project.
I did. Earlier this year, I moved. I've been here for over 6 months now. I moved from New Jersey, so it's really not too far, actually, but far enough. But I love it. It's really fantastic to be around everybody, and I drove over here from my house, so I can't really do that from New Jersey on a work day.
Marcus, you're in a band.
Yes, I am in a band.
But it's not just any band.
Right. There, nobody else is in it.
It's a one-man band.
Yeah. So I play guitar, and I sing, and then I play drums with my feet, and I do all that at the same time. And it's fun. I used to be in a band where I just played guitar and did a little bit of backup singing. And then I was in that for a long time. And then I kind of wanted to do something else. And, my dad was a one-man band.
Yeah.
And so I became a one-man band.
Now, is he a one-man band the same that you are a one-man band? Or was it like more old school, like Dick Van Dyke?
My dad, what my dad would do is when I play, for those who haven't seen me or heard me, I actually sit down and play a bass drum with one foot. And I have a snare and a hi-hat that I use my other foot kind of going between them. My dad would stand up when he performed and just had a hi-hat with a tambourine on top. So as far as percussion, for the most part, that was his percussion. My dad actually stood for his entire show. But my dad had would use the harmonica and the kazoo sometimes.
Oh, yeah. Yes.
And he played guitar. My father was a phenomenal singer. He's a really amazing singer. He did some professional recording way back in the day before I was born. And
nice. Have you ever harmonica'd or kazooed?
Yeah, I enjoy those things. Harmonica I'm not that great at, but it's fun.
Cool.
Kazoo is a lot of fun.
Yeah.
Have you ever found something to play with your third leg?
Whoa. What's the name of your project?
Oh, it's called Nothing Project.
I blew it. Sorry. Your band, I should have said. I already knew the name of it.
We should use Marcus for bumper music.
We could do that. Right now we're using Led Zeppelin. How do you compare to them?
Oh, well, come on. I can't compare to Led Zeppelin, but the music I do, it's one man rock band, it's like a bluesy hard rock, but it's one man. So it's not a whole band. You have to accept that there's not a real drummer. It's just me flopping my feet around.
It's more than just a novelty. Like, it's a cool thing to see for the first time. Like, I remember the first time I saw it, I was very impressed, but the music is good too. And, we've actually used it, Marcus, as music on the show before, not here on the live show, but I've definitely used it on the podcast. Excellent. You also do a daily comic.
Yeah, I do a daily web comic. I've been doing it for over 5 years every day. It's called Brainless Tales. And prior to that, I had a site where I was actually making like flash animations and some games. And that was a lot of fun, but it took a tremendous amount of time. So I wanted to do something that I could produce more of and not take forever to work on. So I said, why don't I just do a single panel web comic? And it's not always funny. Like, if you're expecting something hilarious every day, it's not always funny. Sometimes it's just a drawing.
Yeah.
But it's something every day, and they're short and sweet. So it respects the user's time. There's not much reading involved.
And it's different. I really like your style of art too. I've spent a lot of time going through it.
So you're from New Jersey. You must know our other co-host, Corey.
I do know Corey, as a matter of fact, yes.
Why do you say that?
Because he's from New Jersey.
Yeah, I know everybody in New Jersey.
Everybody in New Jersey would know each other.
Yeah. Right. That's the inference there.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, I don't even need a last name. Just Corey. Yes, I know Corey from New Jersey. No, but I know Corey's on the show. So,
yes, so now everyone knows Corey. Yeah.
Yeah.
But Corey is famous. So tonight, what are we doing?
We're going to talk about the way people think.
Yeah, we've been doing a lot of that. We've been doing a series called Logic Saves Lives for quite some time. Have you heard any of that, Marcus?
I have.
Did you hear our moon landing show?
Yes, I love the moon landing show.
That was my favorite.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, Brett, do you have a second favorite conspiracy?
There's all kinds of conspiracies that you can like. Bill Clinton is a robot.
Yeah.
Have you ever seen him in the rain? Right? That's a real... Now, I have a book called Everything is Under Control by Robert Anton Wilson, and it is an encyclopedia of conspiracy.
Wow.
Ooh. So this is like, you know, Club of Rome, P2, the Gnomes of Zurich, the Freemasons, the Illuminati, everything is in there. And you know, they go from the ridiculous to the probably mostly, if not entirely true. Everything is in this book.
When I was young, my mother bought for my brother and I, the maybe you remember this, The Mysteries of the Unknown.
Oh, and the Time Life series?
Yes, yeah. Yes. And had all kinds of great things.
I loved the hell out of that stuff when I was a kid. Just loved it.
Yeah, it was good stuff.
Well, tonight we are going to continue our Logic Saves Live series, and we want to talk a little bit about emotional intelligence. And we're going to introduce you to something that we might have mentioned a couple times before just in passing, but tonight we're going to get into it. Cognitive distortions. But I came across an article on Reason.com. This piece was called Study Shows Smart Liberals, Conservatives, and Libertarians are easiest to fool. And the subtitle is, We Reason to Persuade, Not to Find Truth. And what I want to try and do tonight,
I'm confused about this idea of a smart liberal.
Like, you know, an academic type.
Oh, I see.
My college professor that I talk about all the time was a smart liberal. They're smart liberals. You got to think Krugman is probably smart.
Don't talk about him.
What is your criteria for smart?
You know, I don't know. It sure seems like liberal would be opposite of a criteria.
Maybe you just have a maybe you have a cognitive distortion that prevents
it seems
you from
like I might.
Putting those two together.
We have gone after the liberals and the conservatives a lot on this show in the past, and they seem to be like in a race to the bottom for the lowest hanging fruit for people like us. Tonight, I think we should turn a critical eye on ourselves a little bit. And by that, that was one of the things that attracted me to this article, because it said libertarians are right there with smart liberals, conservatives, and libertarians are easiest to fool. What I want to discover and talk about, just from our own experiences, maybe mistakes we've made in the past, or things that we've seen other people doing, is this true? Does this hold water? And then we'll look at specific cognitive distortions, and we'll try to find examples. Maybe we'll find a fun one from the mainstream politics. But we can also think about how they might apply to us. And this will be fun.
It sounds fun.
All right. So we're going to start reading this article. I want you to bear with us. It's a little bit long, but I found this very interesting. So, and also bear with me. I have a little bit of a sniffling situation here. So I will do my best. People reason chiefly to persuade others that they might be right, not to find out what is true. So claim Hugo Mercier, a postdoctoral fellow in economics and philosophy at the University of Pennsylvania, and Dan Sperber, a philosopher and cognitive scientist at the Central European University, and their provocative 2010 article, Why Do Humans Reason? Arguments for an Argumentative Theory, in the Journal of Behavioral and Brain Sciences. Now a new study by the Yale Cultural Cognition Project finds that people also use reason to convince themselves, in the face of evidence to the contrary, that they and those on their side are right. So that's the introduction. And if you hear anything that encourages you to participate in this conversation, give us a call, 843-JOIN-SSP. If you're bashful, you know, if you don't want to call in and be on the radio with radio stars, you can just go and get in our chat at schoolsucksproject.com/live. For several years now, the Yale Cultural Cognition Project, headed by Dan Kahan, has been investigating how cultural values shape public risk perceptions and related policy beliefs. The group has issued a fascinating new working paper called Ideology, Motivated Reasoning, and Cognitive Reflection, an Experimental Study, that seeks to explain the sources of ideological polarization over societal risks like climate change, gun violence, and nuclear power. This study investigates three competing theories for why ideological polarization exists. Now, is it fair to say, guys, that it seems like the country, as far as mainstream politics is concerned, has become more polarized in the last decade? Does it seem more vitriolic now?
Maybe. I mean, it almost seems like a kind of show, like a staged play, if you will. You know, like when you go to the theater, like you know the actors aren't up there actually fighting against each other. They're just, you know, pretending for your benefit.
The theater is a little bit too dignified. This is a feeling that I used to have frequently watching something called the Jerry Springer Show, which right. I think is similar.
Yes.
Right? You're saying these people really aren't.
I feel like a lot of my observation of the polarization comes from the media.
Sure.
The people getting engulfed in this media, people that watch Fox News all day long or CNN or MSNBC all day long. And then they, you know, oh, I'm right. And they're, you know, continually telling themselves, I'm right. And then it's very easy to get into that divisive, like, our team, your team, when all you listen to is our team is good, their team is bad, which you get from these major news sources or the popular radio show like Rush Limbaugh.
And they exist for that purpose, too. No one is going to those places. Or, yeah, maybe they think they are, but what they're not getting information there. You know, and I really don't think that deep down, I can't speak for everybody and I don't want to generalize completely here, but those people do not go to those places, whether it's MSNBC or The New York Times or Fox News or talk radio to get information. They go to hear what they are already comfortable believing, pretty much. So as more, you know, left and right media outlets have kind of carved out these niches, it seems like when the population is not thinking very deeply or completely or critically about these issues, they are kind of pushing each other to the extremes, it seems. Or the media, I guess what you're saying, Marcus, is they're dragging people to the extremes.
Yeah, because I don't know. I've only lived the life I've lived, so I don't have much perspective for, you know, when I was a kid, what it was like. But I do feel that having all that media continually pulling people and pushing people and, you know, having that all the time is maybe what makes some of the polarization more obvious.
Yeah, absolutely. So let's pick this back up. The study investigates whether polarization over scientific and risk policy issues arises because people are, one, misled by an over-reliance on rules of thumb, two, subject to distorting cognitive dispositions, such as dogmatism, aversion to complexity, and need for closure, or three, seeking to bolster and protect their sense of social identity. Kahn categorizes relevant social psychological research theories into one, the public irrationality thesis, two, the Republican brain hypothesis, and three, the expressive rationality thesis. One theory of how this polarization arises is what Kahn calls the public irrationality thesis. So this was number one. Nobel Prize-winning economist Daniel Kahneman argues that humans employ two different cognitive systems to evaluate new information. The first uses fast cognitive efforts such as rules of thumb, while the second relies on slower, more effortful, systematic reasoning. People adopt many of their cognitive rules of thumb, heuristics, that are triggered by emotional reactions to new situations from groups with whom they share cultural or ideological commitments. This theory implies that when challenged with new information or arguments, it's just easier for people to believe what their peers believe. The downside of this knee-jerkism is that there is no tendency for public deliberation to converge on effective public policies to deal with societal risks. What's an example of this? Hollywood, where even though you have all of these people who are super wealthy voting entirely, regardless of who they're voting for, they're voting against their own self-interest, but voting for Obama with the expectation that he'll grow the government and raise their taxes is against their self-interest. So what is so powerful about being a liberal in Hollywood? Well, what happens to you if you're not? That's a major liability, I think, to be a free thinker outside of that bubble in Hollywood for a lot of people.
Peer pressure for them to go along.
To conform. But it says it's easier for most people to believe what their peers believe. Now, easier is obviously very vague word, but in that case, it's certainly true. In Hollywood, it is much easier. In that environment, it is much easier to at least express similar beliefs.
I just think of even a conversation with a few people that you know. You know, if they're talking about a subject that you don't have a solid opinion on yet, you haven't, and they all agree, it's easier just to agree with them.
To avoid a conflict?
Sure. Well, you haven't maybe formed a solid opinion yet, and you know, you could just agree along just to avoid that conflict. Certainly easier.
Yeah.
Does it seem like libertarian types tend to be a contrarian personality? type of person.
Like they ruin everything, like, no matter what's going on.
No, like they just want to be disagreeable to any, like you just automatically assume that something is wrong because the government is doing it, or because science is telling me this thing, I automatically assume that the opposite is true.
Well, one interesting thing along that line, I think you might be right to a certain extent. I was talking to Stefan Molyneux one time, and he said, this is something that will attract outsiders, right? Because finally, it's a justification for why you're on the outside. It's not my bad social skills. You know, it's not the way I stare at people for just a little too long.
It's because I'm more moral than
it's the government. Right? I'm not saying it's the government, but it's the government. Government. Yeah. No, I think that that's a really good point. Kahn's second theory is the Republican brain hypothesis. In this case, the supposed negative correlation between political conservatism with traits of open-mindedness and critical reflection means that conservative cognition asymmetrically relies on fast rules of thumb to make decisions with respect to salience of various societal risks. So, negative correlation between political conservatism and the traits of open-mindedness.
Why? I just love the name of this one, the Republican brain hypothesis.
Yeah.
As if there's something about the physical brain of a Republican.
Well, you know, I wonder if there is a certain psychological profile that leads people more, like if you have to insert yourself into this morass, is there a certain personality type that leads people more down the Republican way? Or more down the Democrat or liberal way.
It would have to be, right? Because, I mean, isn't that the definition of conservatism? To keep things the same as they've always been?
Turns out their brain is square.
Right. So, I mean, wouldn't that by necessity require a non-open-mindedness?
Well, I don't know about that. I mean, see, I grew up my father was a Republican, but he was not a typical Republican. He was very liberty-minded and very open-minded.
Sure, but they're talking about conservatism, right? Like people who want things to stay the same.
Sure.
But supposedly they're doing science here, right? So they need to have, you know, some kind of concrete definition.
More simply, this theory asserts that conservatives are less likely than liberals to engage in cognitive reflection and effortful systematic reasoning. Consequently, while liberals evaluate information with the aim of developing useful public policies, fearful, mule-stubborn conservatives will dismiss discomforting scientific facts and spend their time just standing athwart history, yelling stop. All right, so Kahn's bias is definitely identified at this point in the piece. The third theory investigated in this study is what Kahn calls the expressive rationality thesis. In this case, beliefs about issues like the riskiness of climate change or nuclear power constitute part of what it means for people to belong to specific groups. Shared beliefs form part of their identity. People assess new information so that their conclusions signal their trustworthiness and loyalty to social groups with which they identify and to which they wish to be connected. The upshot is that people go along in order to get along with members of the social groups that they believe will benefit them. How does that apply to what's going on here in New Hampshire? Very different political ideology. But are people going along to get along? Do you think people come here maybe not fully studied on a lot of these ideas and just maybe kind of drift along with the crowd?
Within the liberty movement?
Yeah.
Well, I think to some extent, most people have to at some point do that. But I feel like with any political ideology, you're likely going to find people that you trust and look up to. And often you will let them tell you what to think because you don't have all the time in the world to look into this stuff yourself. So when I say tell you what to think, but like, you know, when it's election time, people are going to look up to those who have spent the time looking into this stuff. And they're going to say like, I trust that person. I haven't looked into it myself. I'm going to trust who they tell me to vote for. That's the person I'm going to vote for.
Yeah, we see that too. Like I've seen that posted on Facebook. If you have to vote, here's a list of people to vote for.
Sure. I think that's helpful though, because it's helpful to people. If I'm friends with you and I trust you and I haven't taken the time, but I still want to go and vote. Yeah. Then that's helpful to me. Is it responsible? I don't know. That's for each person to decide.
Yeah. I mean, there's a little difference between just going along with the group and what Brett was talking about, like the NHLA publishes their list of recommended candidates and whatnot. Mm-hmm. Like I've made a decision that these people have done research and I know what their methodology is. And, you know, there's a whole list of reasons why, as opposed to just, I'm doing what I'm told.
But no, don't you think that liberals and conservatives would be telling themselves the same story? Like when they see, like, liberal media and conservative media isn't all just Chris Matthews and Sean Hannity. Like, they bring in people and present them as experts. And then they might say to themselves, oh, well, thank goodness for MSNBC and Fox News that saves me the time having to do this research that they would never do anyway. But maybe there's a lot of people, like, there's things that I think I would probably never look into in great depth and would just, like Marcus said, find people that I determined to be trustworthy. You can evaluate their methodology, their logical rigor, and maybe this in the broader picture is kind of the standing on the shoulders of giants. It's like, it's great that all these people like Rothbard came along before, and I found his book For a New Liberty to be so amazingly helpful in providing clarity in my whole intellectual journey. But I certainly wasn't going to go and get the footnotes and research every single thing that's in that book. But his overall presentation and the cohesiveness of it, you know, makes you think that you're probably safer trusting his scholarship, his research, than a lot of what is available in the mainstream. So I think it can go that way too. But there's ways that you can be more responsible in trusting other people and kind of outsourcing your thinking to other people. And there's ways that you can be really irresponsible
on
this.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think a lot of people don't ever do a check on themselves and who they're following, who they're listening to. At some point, when you are listening to another group or another person to give you advice on what to do, or you're just kind of going along with them because you trust them, at some point you should be questioning. You should always be questioning. Is this the right thing to do? I, you know, even though you look up to them, you should always be questioning it and putting it against your own values. And that's maybe the part that sometimes is lacking.
Yeah. Maybe a good way to evaluate this too is how much emotion is involved in it, right? Because politics seems to be a lot, I think we said this in the first segment, politics seems to be a lot about finding an outlet for anger and trauma and fear and frustration. And that's very emotionally charged stuff. Like, I don't remember feeling very emotional about really anything that I learned in For a New Liberty. You know, like, it was neat. It was exciting. I was excited to get that clarity and to as a student of history, hear about all these different non-mainstream presentations of the facts and economics and the history of education. Like, it was very enlightening, but it wasn't like, oh, I'm so pissed and somebody's got to pay, which I think is like the somebody's got to pay or somebody's got to be punished. It's pretty much like anything you think about any political action in mainstream politics, it seems like there's a victim somewhere. I've had political conversations with people and I've seen them get very emotional. And it doesn't mean that my thinking is always 100% logical. I'm certainly prone to making mistakes because of emotional thinking, like I think everybody is. But that was a very, very emotional conversation for them. And I didn't feel like it was, you know, for someone coming from my point of view.
Yeah.
And there were three working theories as to why people make some of the mistakes that they do. Just to review, the first one was called the public irrationality thesis. The second was the Republican brain hypothesis, which was about sort of stubbornness and closed-mindedness. And the third was the expressive rationality thesis, which had a lot to do with conformity. Kahan points out that both the public irrationality thesis and the Republican brain hypothesis claim that ideological polarization arises from over-reliance on cognitive rules of thumb. The case of expressive rationality is different. Quote, if individuals are adept at using high-level, systematic modes of information processing, then they ought to be even better at fitting their beliefs to their group identities, unquote, says Kahan. In other words, people who have a greater tendency to engage in cognitive reflection will be better able to rationalize their beliefs in the face of any contrary evidence. So if liberals are really more inclined to cognitive reflection and systematic reasoning than conservatives, that would imply that they are, quote, all the more likely to succeed in resisting evidence that challenges the factual premises of their preferred policy positions, unquote. Ever, Osborne, you had some mean things to say about the liberals. How about you, Marcus? Have you ever debated people about some of this stuff? And how has that gone? I don't think we've ever really talked about this.
Yeah, well, you know, I have debated lots of people. I've debated some people that they call themselves socialists. And I think it makes sense that, you know, people that can reason and can, you know, have a thoughtful brain, if you were, you know, but they can, you know, they're clever. So they're clever enough to make themselves sound right. Right.
I was so sure I was right. Now, I told people I came from the left. I was very, very liberal.
Mm-hmm.
And I couldn't have been more convinced that everything that I thought made perfect sense.
Right. For me, I tend to feel like the more I learn, the less I know, you know, because I realize, wow, earlier everything seemed so simple, but there's a lot of layers to peel back. And, you know, so every time I learn something new that I didn't know previously, for me, I think it's a little humbling for me.
Right.
So, but at the same time, then I also do feel like, wow, I've learned a lot, you know?
Yeah.
So,
I always give the example of learning to play the guitar and learning D, C, and G, saying, I should start a band.
Yeah.
And you don't even see, like, there's this hill you climb to see the horizon, right? Yeah. To see how far you actually have to go. And I think it's very easy to feel like an expert on something when you know almost nothing about it. It's when you really start to learn about something that you see. It was at, like, economics.
Yeah.
Especially. And we've talked a lot on this show about when somebody comes out of college or maybe goes into college and they get a year or two of economics instruction, that really, for many people, solidifies their thinking about the subject, because economics is only taught in really one way in college, maybe with a few exceptions. Osborne, what's the good school for teaching economics? Loyola and George Mason?
That's a good one. George Mason's good. Yep.
Yeah. Well, but that's not the presentation that most people are getting. The Yale researchers set out to test these three hypotheses by surveying 1,600 Americans to determine their political party affiliations and ideological predilections. Participants were asked to put themselves on a scale including strong Democrat, Democrat, independent, lean Democrat, independent, independent, lean Republican, Republican, strong Republican. Next, they were asked if they considered themselves very liberal, liberal, moderate, conservative, or very conservative. Once sorted by partisanship and ideology, the participants completed a cognitive reflection test consisting of three questions that aim to measure their dispositions to engage in higher level systematic reasoning. Kahan does not provide the questions in his study, but apparently he used something like the cognitive reflection test devised by Massachusetts Institute of Technology management professor Shane Frederick. That test asks, one, a bat and a ball cost $1.10 in total. The bat costs $1 more than the ball. How much does the ball cost? Osborne.
5 cents.
Whoa.
Wow.
Two, it takes 5 minutes to make 5 widgets. How long would it take 100 machines to make 100 widgets?
Marcus.
Well, Osborne said it, right? It's 5 minutes.
Yep, it would be the same.
Yes.
Three, in a lake, there is a patch of lily pads. Every day, the patch doubles in size. If it takes 48 days for the patch to cover the entire lake, how long would it take for the patch to cover half the lake? This really reminds me of a lot of the SAT math questions.
Yes.
Yeah, which I think provides high school kids with a great opportunity to do some more effortful thinking, as it is called here in the article, and to sharpen their logical reasoning skills, which, you know, just because of the way school is, we don't have to get into the whole processing plant, fitting kids to be obedient industrial workers. But, you know, it is a school is an assembly line. Like, things have to keep moving along. Teachers have to keep checking things off. And because of that, you don't have a lot of time to go in depth with things. So everything just kind of moves along. And it's always for the homework, kids tell me. I never had to do at the end. There's like 2 questions and they say critical thinking questions, never part of the homework, right? Just repetition. That's an unfortunate trait of public school and a lot of private schools.
Homework is an unfortunate trait of school.
Yeah. Yeah. These are some of the reasons why I'm looking to move beyond tutoring, because that's a lot of the stuff that's come my way recently. So keep in mind that unlike the public irrationality and expressive rationality theses, the Republican brain hypothesis claims that there is an ideological asymmetry with regard to cognitive reflection. If conservatism is in fact associated with reasoning traits that lead to dogmatism, fear of complexity, and need for closure, conservatives should tend to score lower on Kahan's cognitive reflection test than would liberals. Once participants had completed the cognitive reflection test, they were divided into three experimental groups. In the first group, subjects were merely told that, quote, psychologists believe the questions you have just answered measure how reflected and open-minded someone is. In the second group, subjects were additionally advised that psychologists had determined that people who accept evidence for climate change tend to get more answers correct than those who reject such evidence. This result was characterized by pollsters as implying that those who believe in climate change are more open-minded than are skeptics. Skeptics are more closed-minded. And the third group was told the opposite. Psychological research has found that people who reject evidence for climate change tend to get more answers correct than those who accept such evidence. In this case, the pollsters implied that research suggests that skeptics were more open-minded than believers in climate change. Each group was then asked how valid they thought the cognitive reflection test was with regard to assessing open-mindedness. Recent polling finds that conservatives are more likely to be skeptical about man-made global warming than liberals. Thus, the Republican brain hypothesis would predict that right-wing subjects would be more inclined to see the cognitive reflection test as valid when told it suggests that climate change skeptics are more open-minded. On the flip side, since left-wing subjects are supposed to be more natively reflective, their assessment of validity of the cognitive reflection test should not differ much between the skeptic is open-minded versus the skeptic is closed-minded conditions. The public irrationality thesis predicts that motivated reasoning, i.e. jumping to conclusions congenial to their social groups, will be higher among people who score low on cognitive reflection, no matter their ideological biases. That makes sense, right? The less reflective, the more likely you are to go along with the group. I think that goes without saying. Unlike both the public irrationality and the Republican brain hypothesis, the expressive rationality thesis predicts that the higher both right and left-wing subjects score on the cognitive reflection, the more their assessments of validity of the cognitive reflection test will turn on their prior ideological commitments. So what did Kahan and his colleagues find? It turns out that conservatives and liberals score about equally badly on the cognitive reflection test. 64% of Republicans and 59% of Democrats got all three questions wrong. In fact, the difference between the two groups of partisans is less than the difference in scores associated with education, gender, and race. Recall that the Republican brain hypothesis predicted that cognitive reflection would be negatively correlated with right-wing ideology. In addition, both liberals and conservatives displayed ideological bias when assessing the validity of the cognitive reflection test. When the climate change skeptics were characterized as open-minded, Republicans thought the test was nifty.
Nifty.
Old Republicans. When skeptics were branded as closed-minded, more Democrats found the test results convincing. Thus, the study finds that the experimental results were more consistent with a finding of symmetry than one of asymmetry with respect to ideologically motivated reasoning. Ideology distorts both left-wing and right-wing thinking.
Imagine that.
Do higher scores on the reflection cognition test temper political polarization? To get at this question, the study compared both liberals and conservatives who scored low on the reflective cognition test, the 62% of subjects who got no answers right, with liberals and conservatives who scored higher, those who got an average of 1.6 answers right, putting them in the 80th to 90th percentile of the sample. In short, the researchers found that the higher either conservatives or liberals scored on the cognitive reflection test, the more likely they were to judge the test as valid when its results supposedly confirmed their ideological views about climate change skeptics and vice versa. People skilled at systematic reasoning use that capacity to justify their beliefs rather than to seek out truth.
So a number of things are disturbing me about the study and most studies like this.
Sure.
You know, especially as a laboratory scientist myself. They're using the word, and again, we're not reading the actual study. We're just reading some guy reporting on the study. So that there might be a level of detail that we're losing here, but they're ascribing this notion of ideology to these two groups of people with regard to this climate change thing. And I don't know if they're using the word the same way I think of it, but to me, ideology is a word to describe your bigotry about crap that you believe that you don't have any evidence for.
Right.
To call someone a climate change skeptic or a climate change supporter.
Yeah.
I don't think it's fair to just automatically label them as an ideologue, which maybe they're a scientist who's spent 20 years studying it.
Right, right? One way or the other.
Yeah, and maybe that's correlated with, you know, not being a dumbass with the, you know, three questions thing.
Right.
And then maybe if you're someone who's actually studied this stuff for 20 years and can answer three simple questions correctly, maybe, you know, and someone tells you that, hey, this is correlated with this, maybe you're someone who believes that.
Well, don't you think right? that that's kind of a selective example? And they're really, with their 1,600 participants in this study, they're trying to cut more into mainstream thinking and not these special examples. And from my point of view, I could understand how I thought I was reasoning my way into being a liberal. I don't know what,
right?
How a person would reason their way into being a conservative. It doesn't seem like that makes any sense to me, just from my own experience.
No, but there's going to be degrees of that, right?
Sure. Okay. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So that's why just asking people questions and expecting them to give you an honest answer, and then, you know, throwing labels on them and categorizing them, I don't really feel like that's the appropriate way to do science.
Could this be like, this is almost like boiling down into like an Onion article, like, a hoity-toity Yale professor did a study where he told people things and they believed it, you know? Like,
exactly. Yeah, you know, the last show, this was one of the things that I wanted to get into, so I'm glad that you brought that up about these studies, because this is something that I actually talked about in the last episode of School Sucks podcast, Myths About Youth. We're trying to finish up this article on Reason.com about a study. Osborne, what did you say? A working paper, something that hasn't even been published or peer reviewed yet.
Right, now, correct.
I have to apologize to everybody. It's been somewhat of a chaotic night. I know this is the kind of thing that I always say, but it's been somewhat of a chaotic night here technically, and also in my nose and throat. And we're running a little bit behind. I didn't anticipate that this would take us more than the first half of the first hour of the show to lead into our actual topic of cognitive distortions. But I also thought this was worth a little bit of evaluation, so I'm glad Osborne brought that up when we were talking about some of the holes that this might have in it, because there's been a lot of studies about youth issues, crime, sex, violence, drug use. If you look at how some of these studies are done, like you say, oh, university study, peer-reviewed study, and you think automatically, oh, all right, well, I could give that the benefit of the doubt in most cases, or certainly that would be the thinking of most people. But how biased against young people a lot of these research projects are, because in academia and in politics, you really can't, if you want to talk about problems or if you have solutions to problems as they relate to sex or violence or poverty, you cannot talk about voting adults. Those problems have to be targeted at this irrational group of dangerous youngsters. Their methods or lack of sound methods for putting together some of these conclusions in these studies is absolutely astonishing. It's criminal, really. So I did want to spend a little bit more time tonight evaluating the validity of this study itself, even though I thought it had some interesting offerings for the direction that we were taking the show in. Now, the good news is that after we're done with all this every Thursday night, I go home and edit it, and I can probably streamline everything we just did down to about 25 minutes.
Nice.
Yeah. And people who want the whole thing can watch it on YouTube if they're into a more kind of chatty, relaxy, back and forthy kind of show.
Good.
Yeah. But for the sake of making my edit as easy as possible, I just want to read the rest of this article. Kahan notes in passing that social psychological research has found that political independents and libertarians score better on cognitive reflections than do liberals or conservatives. But before we libertarians and independents start patting ourselves and our collective backs for being better systematic reasoners, could this simply mean that we are especially good at justifying our beliefs to ourselves? A new Yale study finds that when it comes to thinking about policy-relevant scientific information that challenges their ideological views, liberals, conservatives, and yes, libertarians are inclined to violate physicist Richard Feynman's famous first principle. As the irreverent genius put it, you must not fool yourself, and you are the easiest person to fool. And the smarter you are, the easier it is to fool yourself. Then it gets the correct answers, which Osborne already provided for us, and Marcus already provided for us, and the chat already helped us with, and we're done.
Whew.
So the smarter you are, the easier it is to fool yourself. kind of goes back to Socrates and knowing that I know nothing. That makes me the smartest of all. Or not knowing that I know nothing. I don't think that that's what he meant. But knowing that new information, that I should be open to new information, there's always more stuff that can be presented, and we shouldn't close the book and do this, finality. And I think as people tend to believe that they're smarter, I don't know if that's really true. The smarter you are, the easier it is to fool yourself. The smarter you think you are, the easier it is to fool yourself. No.
Now, I've also seen a study recently that showed that the smarter you are, the more likely you are to recognize what you do not know. So that seems to kind of fly in the face of what they're trying to talk about here.
Ah, but this brings us to, how much do the emotions play into this?
I think a great deal.
And how much can these distortions, even for a smart person, screw things up? We got an after show to do, so yeah. We'll sing, we'll dance, we'll right. swear. And most importantly, we'll continue this topic that we were moving through very slowly during the regular show, and we'll try to bring some detail and closure to that. If you're listening to us on the radio, check us out, schoolsexproject.com/live. We will be back in about 5 minutes. Thanks for listening, everybody, and take care.
Sleigh bells ring, are you listening? In the lane, snow is glistening. A beautiful sight, happy tonight. Walking in a winter wonderland.
All right.
Here to stay.
Yeah!
It's a new bird. Sing a love song. We go along. Walking in a winter wonderland. In the meadow we can build a snowman and pretend that he is Parson Brown. He'll say, "Are you married?" We'll say, "No, man." Do the job when you're in town. Later on, we conspire about 9/11 on fire. A face unafraid of plans that we made. Walking in a winter wonderland.
Instrumental, 14 seconds.
The chat people are just loving this.
Mute.